So here we are and the system is broke. American dream has gone up in smoke. So stop sitting there all broken hearted. Let's get this motherfucking party started. Lady Liberty is ringing a bell, and we're driving us straight into hell. But don't worry, we got what you need. Crank up the volume till your eardrums bleed. Go and make America, America again.
Welcome everyone to the A Better Way to a Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan. Today on the show, we're here with Danielle Campbell. She's a firearms instructor, community organizer, and one of the people behind Protect Peace and 2A Forward. Protect Peace is how I found you, or you found us. Danielle's work lives in the space that a lot of folks are afraid to touch, the intersection of gun rights, community safety, and systemic accountability. Through Protect Peace, she's helping build alternatives to violence that don't rely on policing, while also making sure people have the knowledge and tools to protect themselves and their communities. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Jordan, for having me. I appreciate giving me the space.
Absolutely. We need more people like you doing stuff. You are the man. We've been having some like kick-ass guests on recently. I feel like I'm biased, but you know, I'm so happy that there are other people out there doing stuff that I feel is so helpful to the gun community, because there's, you know, I mean, historically it's been like, okay, you're a gun person or you're an anti-gun person, and there's no nuance. There's no room for the middle. You can't talk about things like community protection, violence prevention. You can't talk about the reasons why, because people start looking at you like you've got two heads. Like, well, what? Wait, now you're starting to sound like a liberal. You're starting to sound like somebody who wants to ban guns or whatever. And there's so much more to it than that. And I love the approach that you've taken, and I love what Protect Peace is doing to try to change that narrative and show that, you know, you can, like, we all want the same thing. We all want to lower gun violence, but we can do that while being responsible gun owners at the same time.
Correct. That's exactly what we want. We want, in short, we always say that gun owners are a part of the solution rather than the source of the problem. You know, anytime these conversations start happening, the conversation begins to center around the gun as opposed to the actual root causes of the violence. And so we just decided that we would put this thing together so that we could really like get in the trenches and kind of try to teach people life-saving techniques.
Awesome. What exactly, for those who don't know off top of their head, like, what exactly does Protect Peace do?
Protect Peace is basically an organization that is pro-gun and anti-violence. So most of the time when people hear pro-2A, they immediately assume that we just want to come out with our guns and we want to fuck shit up, hurt people, and we care about what's going on in communities. That couldn't be further from the real reason that we go out and buy guns is because we want to make sure that we can keep our families safe, and we want to make sure that we can get back home to our families if we're not there with them and something goes down. And so we wanted to give a voice to people who are usually voiceless as it pertains to community violence, and that is the regular everyday gun owner, the responsible gun owner.
Yeah. Sounds like, to take a word out of the gun control advocates playbook, sounds like common sense to me.
Bingo. That's exactly what it is. We want people to, right. We want people to be able to enjoy their weapons, exercise their second rights. But if something goes down, we want to make sure that, like we always say, I think it's our second principle, is that every responsible gun owner deserves a place where they can learn, train, and build positive community. We try to operate off of six principles. Three of them are pro-gun principles. Three of them are anti-violence principles. And we just like mesh them all together. And the main thing is that we get shit done. We're just not sitting on the internet talking and complaining. We're in communities that are most heavily impacted by violence, and we're putting in work. We're organizing range days. We're doing, mental health and de-escalation. We're teaching people how to pack wounds and stop bleeds if there's a shooting that's happening, near them. And we're giving people who would normally shy away from these conversations because they always stem around gun control or restricting, we're giving those people a voice. We're letting them know, hey, these are ways that you can step up and be a part of the solution.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I feel
Danielle,
like-
Sorry, no, I was going to say this is Andrew. He's our co-host.
Sorry.
I'm just some random guy popping in the middle of us talking. I didn't want you to think that we're
No, no, I've been watching, so it's cool.
No.
Oh, okay.
Then you know that I'm often late.
He was so late on the last one, he never showed up.
Sorry.
Poor guy. This guy, I love this. Listen, every day I'm like, people are like, you should have me on your podcast as a guest host. Get rid of Andrew. He's awful.
Yeah,
and I'm like, guys, listen, no, Andrew is the best. Andrew's the glue that holds the show together. I can't do that. And his life is just chaos.
Yeah, Andrew be having some real impactful shit to say. It gets you thinking.
Of course he does.
Well, I try.
Yeah.
I try not to just say like basic podcaster shit, you know, but sometimes it does come out that way.
If you're 34 years old and you're not on your second yacht, you're doing something wrong.
Listen, your net worth is your network.
Which is true.
If your network isn't networking, then you're not networking.
You got to put your net worth to work in your network. Anyways, Danielle, I feel like you touched on something really important here when you were talking about how like you guys you're not just coming out here and trying to like fuck shit up. You guys are about like de-escalation and, you know, responsible gun ownership, because I feel like for people that are uncomfortable with guns, uncomfortable with self-defense, uncomfortable with community defense, I feel like there's definitely this idea that anybody who is getting people together and training is going to be like a militia, and they're going to be like, you know, right wing or some other kind of like fringe politics, and they're going to be like seeking out violent encounters. And I feel like that misconception, and you know, I'm sure that there are, you know, there really are like groups like that out there, but you know, that kind of misconception, I think, really gets in the way of having these conversations. And I think it's like super important, that you guys are standing on business about like, you know, de-escalation and just, you know, presenting like a peaceful but prepared kind of image.
Yeah, I think that's why these types of conversations are necessary, because we do get a lot of that weird shit from people online specifically who may not necessarily be gun people, who've never come out to a gun range. And so we try to make sure that we let people know that we welcome everybody. We welcome the first time shooter. We have these events that we call Shoot the Shit, and we open them up to everybody. Right. We welcome, you know, families. We welcome first time shooters. We welcome women. We welcome victims of crime, violent survivors. And we bring these people onto the gun range and we teach them how to shoot. No judgment. We get a lot of firearms instructors from the community, and we begin at basic, and then we work our way up to more advanced and intermediate shooting drills so that everybody feels like they got something from it. And what we try to teach them is what I experienced when I first like got myself immersed in gun culture, is that the gun range is like the great equalizer. There are people who will talk to me and come up to me and let me shoot their guns and don't even ask for ammo back, that would never talk to me like in Publix. They will walk past me like I didn't exist. But when you get on the gun range, like everybody's friends, it's like the great equalizer. Then you get outside and you start seeing all type of weird trucks with big ass tires, and you're back in reality. But in the beginning, you know, you're like, well, shit, you know, this guy's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And that's just what it is. Yeah. So we try to get people who wouldn't normally come out to come out. And then when we're done with the shooting, we call it Shoot the Shit, but it's a triple prong event. We begin with shooting because we feel like that's what helps build community. When we're done shooting, we break bread, we eat lunch, and then we shoot the shit through conversation. And in those conversations, we talk about things like this. We talk about community safety. We bring people in to do like workshop, do our Stop the Bleed. We have a great organization that we partner with that teaches people he distributes and teaches people how to administer Narcan. We do de-escalation. We've even done some somatics training where we teach people how to do like deep breathing and centering to just calm themselves down when they're, you know, frustrated. We try to give people tools that they need to actually do something rather than just talk about doing something.
I love that. That's the kind of stuff that I feel like really gets glossed over when people talk about the gun community. Cause I think, you know, and I'm guilty of it too. I think we use the term gun community kind of ambiguously, if that's the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I think so.
With like, this is the gun community, and people ask, what's the gun community? And you just say this. Like, yeah, there's not really all the like meat and potatoes
with guns. Right.
All the people that are here, you know. But like, you know, when I say gun community and I use the term gun community specifically, I mean things like, I mean people like yourself and groups like Protect Peace and 2A Forward, and A Better Way 2A, but you know, just groups that are actually that are bringing people together, that are doing things, that are there is something tangible going on that is benefiting the gun community as a whole. And you know, and that could be anything from having training events, having range days, to just getting people together who wouldn't normally hang out and going to get food or going to get breakfast. I mean, you don't have to be necessarily even be doing gun stuff to improve the gun community. Teaching somatics, like, that's something that I would never think of, but that's something that helps people in their day-to-day lives. And if they're a better person because of it, they're going to be a better 2A or gun advocate.
Absolutely. And then we've learned, and I think the way we came up with adding somatic component is we also do leadership development. So we take YouTube influencers or gun tubers, as we like to call them, and people who are Instagram influencers. And we bring them in and we do what we call leadership development. We set them down with a person who can teach them how to talk to the media so that if there's a mass shooting and they're called on, they won't be saying dumb shit to the press. We give them media training. We give them organizer training. We teach them how to engage after somebody has come in and taken your course. How do you further engage with that person to keep them coming back so that they're continuously training and learning more? And so we've done two of those. We have another one scheduled for October of this year where we try to bring in 12 people who have their own community, and we teach them the principles of being pro-gun, but also anti-violence and how to like get work done in the community. And then once they graduate the leadership development program, we co-sponsor an event with them where we kind of like back them in doing something in their community to kind of like just change the culture.
I love that. Something that really struck me when I was reading about you is you yourself have experienced gun violence. And what I find is that a lot of the people that I hear who are vehemently anti-gun and pro-gun control use it as a way to say, well, if this was something that you dealt with, then you would understand. You wouldn't be so pro-gun if you understood. And I don't ever want to diminish somebody's lived experience, because I think everybody's experience is valid. But for a lot of people, that would be a reason to walk away, you experiencing gun violence. But what made you stay committed to gun ownership and choose to lead in this direction?
I'm a little bit weird in this, right? Because I've always liked guns. I've always like been a guns and ammo girl.
You gotta be, so, to be here.
But I also grew up in communities most heavily impacted by violence. So if you know anything about Miami, Florida, I grew up in Opa-locka, and I lived there until I was an adult, a young adult, and a mom. And my neighborhood is so crazy that there was a police substation in my building, in the housing complex where I lived. And the police would come running through the building with guns blazing, like, all the time. And so my first instance with violence is I was in middle school. I know, that's right? Wild. I was in middle school, and I actually witnessed a murder. It's the craziest shit ever, because there was this guy, and he was like the community asshole. And he would say like the craziest things to us kids as we would walk through. And some guy came, and he was giving him a hard time. And I was like, I had the door open. I was cleaning, and I was like shaking sand from a rug. And this guy just, noom, 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 noom. Oh my God, I was so scared. I ran in the house, I slid under the bed, and I didn't come out until my mom got home. That was the very first time that I had seen some shit that I couldn't unsee.
Wait, so somebody shot the community asshole? No, the community
asshole laid somebody down. Like, he didn't give a fuck. He didn't care.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that's, so he, I was trying to figure out if this was like, he was like fucked with the wrong guy, or if it turned out that he's fucking with everybody because he'll just like kill people.
He did that shit. He didn't care that people were outside. It was broad daylight. He did this. And so I was mortified. Yeah. I ran in the house and I was hiding. I stayed hidden until my mom came home because I was petrified. I was like, this guy's crazy. He knows that I saw him. Too much TV, right? I was like, he knows that I saw him. Let me just stay in the back of the, you know, until my mom, and I stayed in. I didn't go anywhere near the front of the house until my mom got home and I told her what happened. And so that was my first like real instance, but it definitely wasn't the last. I had 9 personal instances. The most touching is my brother was shot 9 times in that same apartment complex. He needed to be airlifted out. And most people would say like, oh my God, that was something to see. He had a collapsed lung. He had to learn. And I tell him every time there's church or there's a tent revival, he needs to have his ass there because he was able to walk away from that. No bag, no limp.
He's
perfectly fine. And that wasn't Jesus. He was so fine that he went back and got shot a second time in a different different situation. It was a crate in that exact same building. But this time when it happened, we were adults both times it happened. We were in our 20s the first time. And then the second time it happened to him, he was a big grown man. He didn't even have any business over there. But I think what really shifted like the tone for me was when my assistant was killed. I think I was like 35 or so when that happened. And it struck me because she was just doing an everyday thing, right? She was driving home from the store and she was shot by a stray bullet. And initially I was like, oh my God, living, you know, Miami is a terrible place. You know, it's always something happening. I resonated with me because she was also a mother, same genetic makeup, 2 boys, 1 girl. And I dealt with her every day. She took care of all my scheduling. Like she did everything for me, you know, and I was torn up by it. But it became a real thing for me when a story about what happened to her came out. So there was a guy who was being robbed in the parking lot of library. And he did what I would have done. He pulled out his weapon. He defended himself. But where he fucked up at is he wasn't responsible for every round that left his bullet. He shot out into the main street and 1 bullet took these kids' mother away from them, you know? And it really bothered me because this was the first time that I saw myself on both sides of things. With my brother, you know, it was hard to listen to my mom cry and, you know, we didn't know if he was going to make it. He spent about 2 weeks in ICU and we were, you know, but this was different because I'm like, shit, you know, for the first time ever, I felt what the person who committed this crime may have felt because I was walking around with a gun in the bottom of my purse, no holster, irresponsible as fuck, didn't know how to use the weapon, didn't know how to shoot. I just had it because I always had it. And if I was going somewhere, I would just take it off the shelf, drop it in my purse and take it out with me. And when that happened, that was 2018. That's when I learned that I had to be better. I had to be different. And that's when I started training. So every weekend I was on somebody's range training and I hopped on Facebook and I saw this guy, like, I'm a t-shirt girl. I wear t-shirts everywhere I go. And most of them are Smart Aleck t-shirts. And I saw this guy with a Black Arms t-shirt on. And I asked him, I'm like, well, where did you get that shirt? He was like, oh, this is a members only shirt. You know, we are the first, you know, all Black gun club in South Florida. And he was like, and you remember to get this shirt. And I was like, well, say less. I mean, I shoot. So let's do it. And he introduced me. He introduced me to the chapter. I came out. And for the first time in my life, I really felt like I was a part of a community because I'm in this place. We had a state trooper. We had a state's attorney. We had nurses. Police officers. They were all kinds of people from all walks of life in this place, like learning how to shoot. In my very first club meeting, the co-director of 2A, he had lost his mom and they were all going to go to the mom's service. And I was like, no, it would be weird for me to go. I don't know him. I've never met his mom. And they were like, no, we're a family. Come on, let's go. And so I went. And for the first time in my adult life, I felt like I was a part of this community. It was the first time I really got to see like gun culture, because in my previous training experiences, I was going into like gun ranges and just hiring whoever was there to teach me what I didn't know. And as it turned out, I didn't know a fuck thing. Like I knew nothing. What I thought I knew was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That rules.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's You know, that's the thing I think resonates with a lot of people when they find their niche, is that their gun community is different for everybody. You know, the community that you find amongst gun owners is different for everybody, and it can be shared with other people. But you go to a gun range and you get taught by some dude in a lifted truck with big tires with a Trump flag hanging out the back. There's going to be a very different experience with that person than you would with somebody than getting trained by somebody with the same lived experiences as you. And you know, I'm speaking for people who are not Trump fans, if that's your thing, then that's your thing. Go for it. But I love the fact that there are a variety of gun clubs out there for people looking for different things, because the gun is the unifier. The gun should not be the main point of it. You know, the fact that you're a gun owner is secondary. You are so many other things on top of that. And, you know, we've got women's gun clubs now. We've got National African American Gun Association. We've got the Pink Pistols for queer folks and women and whatnot. And like, you've got so many different niches now for people to get involved in gun culture that did not exist 25, 30 years ago. And I think it's, you know, stuff like that gives me hope for where the gun community is going. Even though we see all this gross shit that's still happening in front of us.
And this is also not to say that like you have to train only with people that look and think like you, you know. But it's really nice that there's like a widening kind of like there's a lot of different perspectives that you might not have found in the training world, I guess. And also that it's shifting away. It seems like things are shifting away from big personality celebrity trainers to like a bunch of like local groups that serve their community.
It's true. And one of the main things that I always try to tell people when they think about like gun spaces, even if the gun space is like black centered, we are not all the same. There are Trump loving, flag waving members of my chapter. Mm-hmm. We don't always agree. We don't all like think the same just because we look alike, but what we do have in common is those shared experiences. And then we love to train, and we've bought in some of those big box trainers, and it's not always the best experience. Like you get more when you train with people who are doing this every day and are not doing it out of celebrity, but they're doing it because they realize that there's a need or they have this love or passion for training.
Yeah.
And not, you know, the fame, so to speak.
Yeah.
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 When, no, that makes sense.
When a training session goes so bad, he makes you sign an NDA before you leave.
So, you know, so you do know. Yeah. It's a lot.
It's never happened to me, but I've heard about it.
We've had some interesting experiences.
Wait, this is a thing?
No, I don't have any specific examples. Just, I just know that sometimes it's like some shit will go down and the guy in charge will be like, all right, nobody say shit. You know, like Sonny Puzica is fucking shooting a guy in his shoot house because there was like a guy in the shoot house and he did a demonstration and didn't realize the guy was in there. Wow. And he was like, he tried to like do like damage control. This was like early 2000s, I think, but just like shit like that.
Well, just bad training all around. Like, you know, you get the curriculum and it's supposed to have all this really cool shit in it. And then you get there and you spend like 45 minutes of a 4-hour class, like doing inconsequential dry firing. There's no real technique in it, but you know, experiences.
Gotta get your reps.
Like $600 later, I could have done this shit at home.
Dude, that's insane. That's the thing, is like, there's so many, you know, we tell people to vet their instructors all the time and give tips on how to do so, but there's so many people out there like, listen, if I could have every gun owner, every new gun owner find the post where we talk about vetting gun instructors, that'd be awesome. But the truth is, there are a ton of people out there with snake oil who, you know, were like GWAT vets from the 2010s, early to mid 2000s, whose experience was very relevant back then, but have not done a goddamn thing since then. And their experience shows. But to a new shooter, they wouldn't know the difference. And so they're going to spend $600 for a 2-day course to learn techniques from some asshole who hasn't bothered to learn anything relevant since his time in the military. And they're going to think they're hot shit. Meanwhile, like everybody at the range who just did a basic 2 to 6 hour course from somebody who's current is significantly better equipped than they are.
Get on a range and quickly learn how much shit you don't know.
Yeah,
that's it.
And it's better to do, you know, it's better to do this stuff sometimes, I think, as a group. I haven't done a lot of this kind of training, so I don't know for sure, but it seems to me like it would be good to have like a lot of different people, not necessarily in charge, but like, you know, when you're training in a group, you've got, you can like bounce things off each other. You can be like, oh, actually that's a myth. You know, that's not helpful. You know, oh, here's a thing I read about today, as opposed to like, you know, even taking like the big celebrity trainer ego personality thing out of it. If you're just training from like one guy who's like ostensibly a professional, you know, he could mean well and he could be trying to do the right things, but there could just be things that he's wrong about that he doesn't know, you know, because he's not taking a bunch of training classes.
And also, I think conversations are so important. Like when we have our monthly range outing, before we step foot on the range, we always spend time in what we call the classroom having a conversation. And then we try to have conversations about like events that are happening, like current events, what's going on in the world, in what we call an open chat. And we just, you know, continually bounce ideas off of one another and just try to keep a good network of other people who are paying attention to these things. Our good friend of Protect Peace is Chris with Equality in Arms. He's usually always like on top of whatever is going on in legislation. Yeah. And he keeps, and just talking to him, it's just so refreshing because he's always so up to date on like everything. I don't even know where the fuck he finds the time.
He's a good dude. I had a conversation with him while I was at work a couple weeks ago. He just we called him, we chatted for like 2 hours.
His brand is relatively new, right? Like he just kind of, because I remember him reaching out to us, and he's got like really good like production values on his like videos.
Chris is one of the first graduates from our very first leadership development cohort. So Protect Peace or Two Way Forward. Protect Peace is a campaign, but Two Way Forward was actually responsible for Chris becoming a firearms instructor because we just saw the value in him. He he's always been so knowledgeable on it. And then when he goes into personal story, like everybody that we brought in for leadership development has a personal story similar to Chris's, like, you know, I was getting, you know, beat up and robbed all the time, and I was not a gun person. Had a couple of people that came through who lost his father to gun violence. We had another who, he's a firearms instructor, but his younger son murdered his older son with a gun that he left in the armrest of his car. So we try to take people who are, I mean, like real serious stuff. We try to take people who got into this work for reasons very similar to why I got into it and help them to shine and give them the tools that they need to go back and teach to the people that they already have in their nucleus, the people that they're already working with.
Yeah, no. And that's a great thing to strive for. And I think Chris is a good example of where I didn't know that he probably told me, but
he just reached out to us, and I, you know, we've interacted a few times, and I've been watching his page, and it's just like, you know, it's like clean. It's like, you know, good, solid brand.
Yeah, Chris has actually helped like with my own personal like presentation for my students. He's actually helped me get my presentation together because he's just really good with like the graphics and the marketing and it doesn't hurt anything that he is so knowledgeable. I think that's what like attracted my counterpart, is actually who discovered Chris in a liberal gun club chat, just talking. He was like, this guy is amazing. Like, we got to invite him to leadership development. Maybe we can get him to start a podcast. Yes, he is.
This guy's hot shit.
And he can shoot his ass off too.
Yeah.
So that's also very helpful to it.
Yeah. You need people that can like, you know, carry the message, right? You need people that can present it in a way that like, you know, cause like I like what we have to say, but I think sometimes that we're not for everybody, you know? And I think it's good to have people that can like go on the news and like not say fuck.
That would not be me.
And like, you know,
I could go on the news and not say fuck.
No, I know you can. I know you can. Andrew? I would struggle with it. I would definitely struggle with it. But that's what I mean. It's like, you
know. I would love to see you on the news though, Andrew. That'd be way more entertaining.
I think if you see me on the news, someone has made a mistake. someone was asleep at the wheel.
Someone either from the news reporting has made a mistake, or they're reporting on the mistake that was made.
Yeah. the guy that's supposed to switch the feeds when things get too spicy fell asleep.
Yeah. Danielle, how, so obviously you're kind of an intersection between two very different groups of people. You got people who are, excuse me, pro gun, and then people who have been victims of gun violence, and, or just people who are not into guns. In your experience, why do you think it's so hard for people who ostensibly have the same goal to lower gun violence to have to work together to achieve that common goal, when one side is coming from the gun owner side and one side is coming from the I don't ever want to touch a gun and all guns should be banned side?
I'm probably going to get beat up for saying this, but I think a lot of it is based in ego. I think a lot of people to be the one to come up with the solution. And I don't think anybody's listening to one another. Every time we have something, we always try to, like, as we go to all around to different cities in the state of Florida, and we always try to look for a violence survivors or advocacy group. And we always try to, like, make sure we invite those people out to our range days, because some of those people want to learn how to shoot. They just don't know where to start, or they don't feel like, you know, they would be a part of community. But I think that we aren't having the right conversations. And so one of the things that we're planning for next year is we're working on a pro-gun anti-violence summit. We did do a panel just to kind of like test it out to see how it would go, where we actually brought leaders in the anti-violence space and in the Second Amendment spaces together to just have a conversation. The anti-violence people actually sat on the panel and they actually shared their story. The firearms instructors and gun club leaders that were in the room. And the conversation was so impactful that his idea to do a larger convening of that group to try to be the bridge for that conversation. Because I do feel like this conversation needs to happen. Every time something happens, immediate conversations start weaponizing mental health and villainizing the guns rather than looking at root causes to all of these things and figuring out what we can do to try to get resources into communities where people are needlessly dying, so that these norms that we have will begin to shift. And if you ask me, the perfect people to get that work done are the gun people, because we've already shown up demonstrating that we give a fuck about these things. We care about community violence. We care about what's happening in communities. But what will happen is when these conversations start, gun people will run off and shy off into the corner because the conversations are mostly based in restriction. And so we want to try to push out communication that shows that there's a and for lack of better terms, a better way to do this shit. And so that's what we're trying to do.
That's awesome. Yeah. And that's something that it needs to be a two-way street. There needs to be an exchange of information and ideas from both. I hate to even use the term sides, but both,
both
sources of input. Yes. Both perspectives. That's a much better word. I don't know why I don't use that.
Because the whole conversation is dominated by people that feel like it's one side versus the other. It's I'm right, you're wrong. We can have this conversation, but the outcome is I'm going to convince you that I'm right and you're going to run away crying. You know, it's like, you know, they're very adversarial about it. And there's not enough people that like Danielle is saying, want to listen, you know, that want to like get up there with someone who's anti-gun because something terrible has happened to them and understand what happened and why they feel the way that they feel. Even knowing that's not going to change your mind about being pro-gun, but just like taking in that information and listening without judgment is just, it's so rare in this space, in this culture, you know?
On that panel that we sat down with Oswald Thomas, who is the president, if I'm not of the Alliance for Justice, he told us a personal story about how he was on his way to go and play professional basketball overseas. And he had gotten shot in the back. And I think that changed everything for him. So he started this organization where he tries to give victims power. And then also on that same panel, we had Akiva Sherrill, who they said was very instrumental in like putting together the truth between the Bloods and the Crips, who also lost his son to gun violence. Son was home from college on a break and went to a party and ultimately, you know, lost his life. And we, what we did with these guys is we took them to the gun range and we shot with them first. We did the somatics, we shot, we breathed, we ate, and then we started to talk. And they both agreed that the work that we're doing is important for people to see. Because when people think about gun, they see is the representation that is what they see on the news or what they see in TV shows. And then they just make all of these, they pile on all of these assumptions that do nothing to help anybody. So we try really hard not to engage at all in any gun debate, because we know that debates don't save lives. And we just try to get people to like get active, do some shit.
Yeah. And there's a, there's enough people debating, and they both perspectives are very well represented, I think, in various different spaces that, like, you know, I think it's crazy to be like, you know, I'm going to jump into this debate and I'm going to change things. I'm going to tip the scale, you know? So it makes a lot of sense to me the way you're talking about that. Like, you know, instead of like getting into the culture war, we're going to focus on, you know, proven methods of saving lives.
Where do you think investment is most needed? Because that's something that, you know, we talk about all the time with as far as investing in disenfranchised communities, investing in better school systems, after school activities, you know, like mental health care and things like that. But we're using a garden hose to fight a big fire, in the sense that there's not a ton of resources, it feels like, coming in, and there's so many places that those resources need to go. What do you think is the best way to invest either time or money or both to have the most immediate or biggest net improvement to lower gun violence?
So I think we have to go directly where the violence is happening. I think there has to be a targeted approach to community violence and wellness intervention, and it has to happen simultaneously. You can't just say, oh, we're going to go and we're going to focus on mental health, but then ignore all of the other reasons that community violence is happening. And I don't think most people who don't live in communities that are most impacted by this stuff, I don't think that they realize that violence comes in a lot of different ways. So a lot of these communities are food deserts. There aren't any quality jobs in these areas. People don't have access to resources. And so they're walking around already with a chip on their shoulder. You know, you watch these videos and you see these people that are getting like pissy with the police, but you're not thinking that this person is being pulled over because a light or something is out in the back of their car, but they know that they're late for work and that they've been told that if you're late again, your ass is gone from here. And so there are a whole bunch of layers to the things that are happening that cause violence in communities. And I don't think that we're taking the appropriate steps to get to the root causes of those things. So I think there needs to be a targeted approach that is layered that targets both community violence and wellness intervention.
No, I think that's so huge, because that's and that's such a, just the way you say that, without like scapegoating anybody, without being like, you know, like placing blame on like a people, on a person or a group of people, to just be like, you know, like there are these problems and, you know, we can identify them, you know, empirically, there's data to support it. And if, you know, if we get the resources to go after it, you know, we can really make a difference. I think just shows a really like, shows like a really kind of level-headed approach, kind of detached from the culture war that I think is just rotting everybody's
and
brain.
And it's sickening, because if you think about like something as basic as like the approach that Head Start takes. Head Start is a program that is geared towards small children. They have an early Head Start 0 to 3 and a Head Start that's 3 to 5. But what they do is they don't just like pour into this baby or this kid that's in school. They pour into the entire family. You think about it. If you go and you put up this, you know, this rec center in the neighborhood, you're appealing to one piece of what's happening here, rather than if you follow a model like Head Start and you invest in the child while the child is in the school, but you also invest in the parent because you understand that child has to return home into that environment. And so it has a multi-layered approach. It has to be a long-term investment, and it has to be in both economic, criminal justice, and public safety. Those things have to happen at the same time in order for it to be successful.
Yeah. And I think that's something that people get caught up on is, you know, long-term solutions don't win elections, and people want to believe that a politician is going to come in and the promises they make to improve their lives are going to be followed through on. And whatever that improvement is, for a lot of people, especially in the gun debate, that is, you know, we're going to do something about the gun violence epidemic. And they all kind of say the same thing, but they don't ever really elaborate on what they're going to do. They just blame the other side for when they can't pass gun laws.
And yeah. That's what they mean. That's what they're going to do.
Yeah, exactly. And it's something that is, it's so frustrating because I think that it really, it furthers the otherization of gun owners to this degree that we are the reason gun violence is continuing, because our politicians, quote unquote, are the ones voting against these things, without talking about the fact that, you know, this proposal that was tried to that they tried to pass to, quote unquote, lower gun violence would never have worked, or would work in the immediate time frame for only a specific group of people. There's so many similarities between the war on gun violence and,
yes,
and the war on drugs.
Yeah.
And we see where that got us.
Yeah. And who's the primary target of the violence in the war on drugs, and who are the beneficiaries of the spoils of that war?
Largely the same. Like, as a white dude growing up in the suburbs, like I was not exposed to a lot of this stuff. So for me, it was completely out of my realm of understanding until I started talking to people, and we start talking about gun laws and how they disproportionately affect Black and brown communities. And then you look at the war on drugs and you're like, wow, a lot of the laws that went into the enforcement of this drug war affected Black and brown communities as well. And I can't help but think that there's, my tinfoil hat comes out and it's like, well, this is obviously done on purpose. And obviously history shows us that there are things that are done on purpose.
It's not that crazy.
No, it's not that crazy. But sometimes you say these things and people look at you like you have two heads. Like, but like we've said that, like there's historical precedent to show that laws have been made to disproportionately hurt Black people. And it's not that, it's not out of the realm of possibility that those things are still happening. And where is the majority of gun violence happening? In Black and brown neighborhoods. Yeah. And where are those laws going to be disproportionately enforced?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't know how to get these like NIMBY liberal people to realize what they're doing is hurting groups of people that they have never, like they don't understand.
Right. So
they don't understand the.
I just wanted to say, I get, and this is a revelation that I had really recently. I get really frustrated talking to Jordan, like you said, like NIMBY liberal types. Cause it's like, you know, we just touched on, you know, a disproportionate amount of violence happens in Black and brown neighborhoods. It's like, okay, we know why that might be, you know, because of the disenfranchisement and the oppression of minorities in this country. Right. But as soon as you say that, sometimes in a conversation with like a NIMBY liberal, they'll peg you for like, you know, oh, you're going to say something about race science, or like, oh, you're going to make like, you know, like cultural or like genetic arguments. And, you know, you get written off before you even get to talking about like redlining and, you know, like, you know, the desperation of being like economically oppressed. And you know, it's like the tinfoil hat comes back on. It's like, you know, you're getting this like two-prong approach. You're getting like, you know, gun control from the left. You're getting like racism and like, you know, cultural crap from the right. And it makes it like really difficult for anybody to hear like a sound argument and like understand what you're saying, because you're not coming from one of these like mainstream polarized perspectives.
Very true. So remember when I those six principles, that's our third principle, simply read that the war on guns must not become the next war on drugs. And it's for the exact reasons that you stated.
Yeah.
You know, that we realize that most gun laws are punitive, restrictive, and they come with fines that most people in Black and brown communities just simply cannot afford to pay. And so I always say it, and people get mad at me when I do, but I feel like any form of gun control is racist. We understand where it got its roots. We understand the very first times that these things were actually supported by big groups, and we know what this means. And so we need to figure out ways to kind of like make sure that the conversation is around investments rather than restrictions.
Hell yeah. I'm gonna have to remember that and just like keep that stuck in my brain, investment rather than restrictions. Cause I think that's the first time that I've really like heard that and understood like that like what that means, what that phrase really means.
Well, you look at it like there's so much that we've learned about. I'm going to draw a similarity that I understand as a parent. We've learned so much about childcare in the last like couple decades.
Yeah.
That we've now determined that, punishing kids in the way that we used to punish kids does not make them better kids. Figuring out why they're behaving in the way that they're doing and investing in the time that it takes to correct that behavior or to figure out why that behavior is happening in the first place is what turns them into better behaving kids. So we do that now because it's the science is there that says you're not going to teach your kid that you're not going to improve your kid's life by scolding them and putting them in timeout. You're not going to improve a community by throwing the community members in prison when something bad happens. You need to figure out why bad things are happening and fix those problems. And that's exactly what we do. Like, it's so easy to do it in the small environment that is our household now. But why can't we convince people that we need to do that for our neighborhoods as well?
Okay. Correction, point of order. It's actually not easy. It's actually really hard. It takes a lot of work.
It's easy to understand. But that's the thing. It's easy to understand. This is what. Yeah. It's much harder in the moment to be like, okay, she's not giving me a hard time.
And that's essentially what it is. But we don't do that. And I don't understand why we don't do it. If I could impress one thing upon people, it would be that debates or restrictions do not save lives. Like, none of those things that we're doing saves lives. We've been doing them over and over again. You know, you have people calling for gun control. And then when you ask them, like, do you know how many gun laws actually exist? Do you have a clue? Like, you're calling for this thing and this thing is already a thing. But did you know that? Or are you just saying what feels good to you in response to something bad that happened? In response to something that doesn't feel good. And if I could get people to understand that, I think that we would. My co-director, he uses this statistic all the time. He talks about, I have it written down and I hate reading for people, but I want to say this because I think that when people talk about all of the things that they care about, when you think about 100,000 people dying from drug overdoses and an additional 100,000 people dying from alcohol-related death, many of the deaths that happen, guns, drugs, and alcohol, all of this stuff is happening in the exact same communities. And in a lot of instances, this shit is happening in the exact same families. We keep coming up with all of these get tough approaches, but none of this shit is working. And so it's like, okay, what can we do to kind of change some of this stuff, if not everywhere, but like where we are? And then once we get like data to show that this stuff is working here, how do we get this to scale? How do we get people to do this in other communities, even if we can't be there to like walk them through how to do it? Like, let's create a toolkit or something and let's figure out how we can replicate this work in spaces, even if we can't physically be there. What we're doing right now is just not working.
No, I agree. And you know, that's one of the things. It's like the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again. Even though expecting different results. And I think people are so caught up in this culture war of getting at the opposite side and feeling like you're right and they're wrong that they're not realizing they're repeating themselves or that they're banging their heads against the wall and wondering why their heads hurt. One of the things that bothers me the most about these common sense gun control organizations is that they have so much capital. They have so much ability monetarily to impact the communities that they say they care about. But they use it on lobbying for politicians to vote a certain way. And then when the law that they wanted to pass does not pass, they blame all of the results of the inaction on the opposite side. So the fact that there are still people dying, still school shootings happening, it's because the other side did not vote the way they wanted to. Meanwhile, millions of dollars invested in communities. Like, it doesn't sound like a lot in the grand scheme of things, but these are not million-dollar organizations. This is the gun control apparatus, if you will. Now I sound like a weirdo, but it's a billion-dollar industry. Yeah. And
there's a lot of so many things. A lot of people are getting paid.
Yeah, there's 100%. There's so many things that can be done with that money that do not require waiting for legislators to move their asses.
Yeah,
that have real world immediate impacts. And that's the thing that I want people to realize is, like, we need to start holding these people accountable. You're holding on to all this money and you're promising these things. It's just, you're just as bad as a politician who's saying that they're going to do something and then fail to do it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just as bad. And it's, man.
How many meal kitchens do you think Bloomberg could have funded with everything he donated to, his gun
givers? I never want to talk to any of these people, but Bloomberg is one person that I would love to talk to. I would love for him to just open up. Again, I'm nosy and I go online and I look at things. I would love to know if you actually took the billions of dollars that you spent over the course of the time that you've been doing this and funding these websites with these twisted statistics and all of this crazy information that people just look at and take as gospel. If you took a fraction of that money and invested it in the type of work that we're doing, there would be immediate changes on the ground. You spend it to run these ads and say all of this crazy shit and nothing has changed. You've been successful at nothing. Yeah. Like, nothing. None of it has worked. And then, but every cycle, this is the approach. And I just want to understand how it makes sense. Like, you look at prohibition, you look at the war on drugs, and you see that these things just did not work. And then you come back and you're going to do it again.
This is where I get salty and I say, it's not intended to work.
Yeah. And that's what I was going
to
say.
It's intended. I don't think functionally it's meant to solve the problem. I think what it's meant to do is keep the hamster wheel moving, the hamster wheel of funding going, but from donations from empathetic parents who do want to make change and who think that they're spending their money wisely. And I don't think the moms in Moms Demand Action on the ground level are bad people. I think the ones up top who run the organization and know where the money's going and what's not happening are morally corrupt.
Yeah.
But I don't think the majority of their followers are bad people. I feel the same way for most of these organizations.
Like, if those moms, they're demanding action, it's just unfortunately not the correct action. And if we could get in front of a group like that.
And the people get them that, active, that they're demanding.
Because a lot of them own guns. Yeah. A lot of them shoot.
Yeah, man.
Craziness.
And I always kind of think that there's, like, two options, right? Like, with someone like Bloomberg, either he is truly a vicious racist idiot, or he is knowingly, like you said, just keeping the funding machine going and just lying to everybody. And those are both kind of bad, right? Like, I mean, neither one of those is, like, a great look.
Or two things could be true.
You know? Yeah. True. True facts. You know, and I think about, there's a quote from Bloomberg from an interview with him. I think this was in the 90s. I think maybe he was, like, mayor or something at the time. He was in charge of something and they were asking him why, at his behest, the police were focusing on these black neighborhoods in New York City. And he said, because that's where the crime is. Which either completely misses the point of the question or is just, like, viciously, brutally sarcastic.
And it shows how tone deaf he is.
And it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to tell.
It just shows just how tone deaf he is. You take a group of people, you pigeonhole them into the shittiest places known to man. You limit the resources. There's no access to nutritious food. There are no quality jobs. And then you want to know why shit is happening. Like, be for real.
Yeah. And
people talk about these, like, takeovers. And, you know, like, when I lived in New Haven, the big thing was, like, people riding dirt bikes and quads downtown. And there's such a weird disconnect that people have I rode motorcycles for years. And a lot of my friends were in the circles that rode motorcycles. But knowing how much fun they had on motorcycles could not even begin to fathom why kids would get on these unregistered motorcycles and dirt bikes and quads and go ride down the street. And I this conversation came up once. I remember talking about how it was a way for people to do something fun who didn't have a lot of fun things to do. Yeah. And like that's,
or didn't have, the money to go to the place where everyone says it's okay to do it.
Oh, go ride the trails like everyone else. Yeah. You mean the trails that are 85 miles away that you need a pickup truck and a trailer and
you got to take off work and you got to buy gas and you know, like,
and it's crazy. Like,
we'll just fucking,
I can disagree with something being done. Like, I don't think stopping traffic and doing donuts in the middle of the road is a good thing, but I also don't think that people do it because they're bad people. Yeah. I think people do something like that because they're trying to find happiness. They're trying to do things that are fun, just like you and you and I do, but the resources are significantly more limited. To, like you said, there's food deserts. There's fun deserts too. Yeah. There's like entertainment deserts. Like you go to a lot of these cities and it's just where people live. Yeah. There's nothing else. And
that's exactly what it is.
Like third places.
You go to a community where there's lots of despair and there's nothing to do. The parks don't have, the basketball hoops are down. There's nothing to do but like walk around. So if you see people, like the kids get together and it's hundreds of them and they ride bikes. And then the police started harassing them, like bikes up, guns down, not even necessarily blocking traffic, but just riding in a space where you're not supposed to ride. Yeah. And then it turns into a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen cases where cops show up just there's too many black people in one place and they just show up and they're like, get out of here. Go home. You know, like
it's loitering.
It's crazy to me. You know, I'd never,
you get caught loitering or you're trespassing.
In my neighborhood, kids are out in this. Yeah, your kids are out in the street playing all the time, but it's just like too many of them and they're just the wrong kind of people and that's a crime.
But that's the thing. You'd rather arrest or fine people who can't afford to be arrested or fined than to figure out why those things are happening in the first place. Figure out why there's 30 people hanging around at a gas station at 2 o'clock in the morning. Maybe fix that problem and then you'll get rid of the people who are loitering.
Yeah. And also, you know, here's another tangent. When somebody grows up their whole life realizing that every time they try to do anything to improve their circumstances, they're going to be charged with a crime or threatened with being charged with a crime, they're not going to feel the same way that you and I feel about crimes and like what that means for themselves and for society. You know, like it's just not.
What do you mean? Like,
well, no. So it's like, okay. So imagine you go your whole life and everything that you do, a cop shows up and is like, you know, you're a criminal for doing this. And then by the time you're 18 and you got to make money and you can go get a job or you can go rob somebody, you know, it's like, oh, I've been doing crime. I've been doing crimes my whole life. Like they told me that just being alive is a crime. And now it's like not uncomfortable.
And I think that's why we got to give people things to do.
Yeah, like a desensitization.
Give people spaces that they can be in, movements that they can feel like they're a part of, things that they can do to kind of sift some of that. So, for example, one thing that is heavy here and in places like Chicago, you have people who pick up their first, like you said, crime because they're carrying a weapon because they didn't know, like, okay, I'm 21. I can legally carry this weapon. But nobody's teaching that.
Right.
So they get the gun and they go out with it, not realizing in places like Chicago that they need a FOID card in order to be able to do that. And so now you're a convicted felon and all you want to do is protect yourself. So that's one of the reasons why we believe that you're supposed to get out into the community and make sure that people understand that they have rights, what those rights are, how to exercise those rights, and then how to be a part of something positive. Here's something positive that you can do with this thing that you now have, with this tool that you now have, with this newfound. Because for me, shooting is about safety, but it's also fun. Like I enjoy going to the range. It's therapeutic. Yeah. These children start getting on my nerves in this house. I'll go to the range. I'll find me something to do, you know? So it's just about making sure that people understand those options.
Yeah,
and a lot of people don't understand them. And then in black communities specifically, gun ownership is very taboo. They feel like if you're not military or police, then you're not supposed to have a gun. So for a long time, I wouldn't like post about being a gun owner. I wouldn't post about going to the range. And then my chapter's vice president kind of like doubled down. And he was like, how are we going to change the narrative? How are we going to show people what responsible gun ownership looks like if you, a mom, a grandmother, a manager, are unwilling to talk about this thing? How does it become more normal And so then I just went crazy. And I'm like, okay, well, let me just show you what I got today. Let me show you a picture of this. Let me show you that. Let me show you what I'm doing on the range this week. And it just became a thing. Like, I never saw myself becoming a firearms instructor and wanting to, like, teach people. And I don't really teach classes. I mostly work with, like, battered women. It's my community service. I take women to the gun range and just, like, teach them how to shoot, how to be safe, you know, and just assess and make, trying to make sure that they're not in an already domestic situation before I kind of, like, encourage them to shoot. And just giving people skills and tools that they need to, and teaching them how to decompress. Because, like I said, it's therapeutic. It's the new shoe shopping.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, you said it. There's being hesitant to tell your community and, like, your friend group that you're a gun owner is a very real thing. There's risk involved with that for a lot of people who are gun owners, but don't feel that they can openly express that with their family, their friends, for fear of how they're going to be perceived. But the only way to get past that is to normalize gun ownership. And, you know, as much as it sucks, somebody has to do it. Somebody has to be the one to get that snowball rolling. And something that I've heard for years is that there are more gun owners than you know. Every time somebody from the anti-gun side fetishizes what a gun owner looks like, there are a dozen people around them who carry guns who they would never expect.
Yeah.
And that's because it's this certain idea of what a gun owner is has been normalized. And we need to do a better job of normalizing that the average person can own guns, and this is what they look like. They look like you and I and Andrew.
Sometimes. I had a friend, a former colleague who was running for office. He's a gun owner. He liked shooting. He wanted to join our local chapter. But he was, like, really, really concerned about people knowing that he was a gun owner. And I was like, you know, you might be very surprised that you might get more support, because there are more people who are gun owners than you know. And that's kind of, like, a part of the reason why we started this, because gun owners are often seen as, like, a part of the problem rather than a part of the solution. And so we are in a lot of these spaces already. We're just not telling people that we are gun owners. You know, we are at the school board meetings. We are in the community spaces, you know, volunteering and feeding the homeless. But nobody knows, because we got our weapon properly concealed, and we don't feel comfortable, like, being out front, because we get villainized so much. So we want to kind of change and put responsible gun ownership front and center. And we want people to see us doing, like, really impactful and cool shit. That's important, you know?
No, I agree. It's one of those things, like, it's, so I'm getting ready to next weekend. I try not to say things that are going to date the episode, because I don't know when these episodes come out, but next weekend we're going to Middletown Pride, with a bunch of really cool people. And I'm expecting, the way that it goes with most public appearances, where, you know, the majority of the people who approach the tent are going to be happy to see us, but there will be an occasional experience that could be used for growth. And I think these things, just getting out in public and showing people that, hey, there are people out here who are not who you thought, and they own guns, is really important to furthering that normalization. Because whenever you have somebody who, we were talking about Fox News in the last episode that we recorded, not the one that is going to air. Right. We were talking about how Fox News is really good. A lot of news, but Fox News specifically is really good at painting a picture in people's minds of who their enemy is. So when you go to that person and they are fully expecting you to be the enemy, and you show that you're not, or they think that you are on their side and you show them that you have a difference in belief, that dissolves that narrative, that dissolves that foundational belief that, okay, maybe everything that I've been told is true. And then it becomes much easier to open up that conversation to a less adversarial one, if that makes sense. You know, you, by going out and showing people that, hey, normal people own guns. I love, oh man, Andrew, what's his name? Who? Normal people own guns.
Oh, Jesus Christ. What was his name? We had him on the podcast. David? He wrote, yes, David Yamane?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He wrote books. He writes books. Gun Culture 2.0 guy.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. He says owning guns is normal. Normal people own guns. And that's an idea that is so pushed back against by the people who stand to profit from maintaining the idea that no, owning guns is not normal. That, you know, just showing up and doing what you do and being a rational voice and being an irrational example of what a gun owner is, I think does so much to refute that. That was a long-winded way to say that showing up is good.
Thank you for acknowledging that, because believe it or not, there are people, sometimes even my own mother is not the most understanding of what I'm trying to do or why. Not that I give a half, because this is necessary, but it feels good to be amongst people who understand, you know, what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Feels good to be understood.
That's what people want, really. That's what Larry from the Enemies Project said, was that everybody has this deep need to feel understood. That's literally what makes us feel like we are loved and heard, and you know, that's really just what we all want. I have a couple other questions. I'm just trying to see.
Hey guys, I hate to do this. My wife is sending out the SOS, so I got to duck out early.
No, no problem.
Okay.
Don't end the episode, because this
thank
is
you, going Andrew. Very well. It's a pleasure meeting you.
It is. Oh yeah, you just texted me. Thank you, Andrew. Yep. Thank you for helping.
All right.
Likewise.
It's been cool. I'll catch up with you guys later.
All right. See you, buddy. Danielle, we touched on pretty much everything that I wanted to talk about. I feel like this was a very productive episode, and you know, I'm so glad that you came on and that you're doing this where you are, because we need more rational voices out there. We need more people who represent the gun community in a good way. You know, there, like we were talking about earlier, there are tons of gun tubers who I cringe when people are getting into guns and mention that they were the first person that they took advice from, or that they saw and they watched their videos, because there's just so much stuff out there that I feel like does not help further the conversation. And not that there's anything inherently wrong with it, because it's entertainment for a lot of people, but it doesn't do anything to help us when our goal is to garner understanding from people who wouldn't normally take the time to understand us. So I'm so glad that you're out there and that your team's out there doing this stuff, because I really do believe that it is so vitally important to the future of gun rights in this country. And I've got nothing.
Thank
but respect
you so
for
much.
You.
No, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate you having us on here. I'm about to do a little shameless plug. What we want is for people all over the place, whether you live in a community heavily impacted by violence, whether you work in one, or whether you just know that they exist and you want to create a better tomorrow. I would ask that you go to our website, www.protectpeace.com, and just patch in with us as we work to develop more ways to build better futures for everybody by being pro 2A and anti-violent. And also, you can find us on Instagram at Protect Peace Together.
Heck yeah. If you had a piece of advice for people, either related to what we're talking about or not, just something that might help improve people's lives or whatever, what would that piece of advice be?
I think that everybody needs to know how to protect themselves. So let's just say, for instance, the gun is not your thing, but I think everybody needs a mechanism for self-protection, and everybody needs a mechanism for, you know, saving lives. So if you take nothing away from this, find something, a way, even if it's just getting into a jiu-jitsu or a martial arts class, find a way to defend yourself, and then learn a life-saving technique. Take a CPR class. Most hospitals have Stop the Bleed workshops that are at no cost to attend. Learn Heimlich maneuver. Learn something that you can do in your community to save lives, if nothing else. I would ask that everybody do that.
That's a good piece of advice. There's a lot out there that people can do that I don't think they realize they can do. you know, maybe not so much our audience because it's probably mostly gun owners or people, but, yeah, or people. Yeah. I don't know. I hope it's all people. There's jiu-jitsu is great. I cannot wait for my daughter to get to the age where she can appreciate it and do well with it. Because I feel like it's such a valuable skill to have, but yeah, stop the bleed, learn to shoot, all that fun stuff.
I have these little, really cool little things that I use to train, like moms, and they have kids in the house, and they have weapons in the house. I have these really cool little training. It's almost like a toy that I use to help to even just see what their kids would do if they left the room. I'll send you a link. It's a good thing to have, especially if you know you have weapons in the house for your baby. She sounds so cute and it's funky.
Yeah, I've had a lot of conversations about when would be the right time to start talking to her about guns and at a level that's appropriate to her. There's been a couple times where I've been wearing, you know, my gun and I carry appendix where she's like climbed onto my lap and it's obviously holstered and there's no way she could pull a trigger, but she notices it and I kind of brush it off and like, I'll go upstairs. 99% of the time, I think it's only happened once. When I get home, I usually excuse myself. I say, oh, daddy will be right back. I have to go upstairs and I go and put it in my safe. But you know, I want her to know, I want her to be comfortable with what a gun looks like. I want her to know what a gun looks like. And I want to know how, I want her to know at a bare minimum what to do if she ever finds a gun. So that's something that, you know, at some point we'll have that conversation, but
that's a great starting point. Just if you see this, what would you do? And you have some cool little kids books, you know, but mostly just, you know, through conversation. My granddaughter is 7, but she's still extremely hard headed. So she has had no like real education, but yeah, I think it's important that exactly what you said, each child has a point where you will know if they're ready to get that education. Like my granddaughter is 7 and I still haven't taught her anything because she doesn't listen very well. You ask her to do something, she's still laughing and, you know, she thinks everything is funny. And this is a skill that I need you to be able to listen. Like when I ask you to stop, I need you to stop. I don't need you to and just keep going. So she hasn't had, she just knows basic stop, don't touch, you know, tell an adult. He doesn't have any like skills outside of that as it pertains to a gun because she's not there yet. So I get that.
It's different for everybody. You know, I'm sure that it's going to be a similar situation for us. I have an echo again on your side, but that is probably something I did when I left and came back.
It's okay. I think that thing was great. And again, thank you for doing
that. I think it went well.
I appreciate the space. I look forward to seeing what you come up with, and I'll be watching because I'm a watcher now.
Oh yeah, leave a review.
I will. I know I subscribed, but let me get the numbers up. So I did. I will. You want it on YouTube or you want it on
wherever we do. I know we've got a decent amount on Spotify. Apple's pretty. Apple is a review desert for us, but
I'll go over there.
Cool. But yeah, no, if you're check out Protect Peace and what Danielle's doing, and it's so funny with this echo. I remember seeing videos of people trying to talk while hearing themselves. Oh, that actually helps. Sorry about that. While hearing themselves talk, and they sound like they're losing their mind because they can hear themselves talk at a delay in like a soundproof environment. It's a really funny thing, but anyway, yeah, I appreciate you coming on. This was an awesome conversation, and if you guys like this episode, go check out our Patreon. That's it.